Hi, this is Steve Magnus, and you're listening to the Run to the Top podcast.
Hi there, my running friend. This is Coach Claire Bartholik, the Planted Runner, and this is the Run to the Top podcast, one of the first and only running podcasts dedicated to making you a better runner with each and every episode. We are created and produced by the expert team of running coaches at runnersconnect.net, where you can find the best running information on the internet, as well as running coaching plans to fit every runner and every budget. We all know that there's more to getting the best out of your running than just training more. You can be the fittest you can possibly be physically, but if your mind isn't on board, there's simply no way you can reach your potential. With pro runners, there's often little physical difference between second and first place. They're all highly trained and genetically gifted, but they are not simply good at training their bodies. They all work on training their minds. Now, most runners are realistic enough to know that we're never going to be as physically talented as the elites. But is it possible that we can train our minds to be just as tough? Steve Magnus thinks we can. If you're not familiar with him, Steve Magnus is a world-renowned Olympic-level coach and expert on performance. He is co-author of Peak Performance and the Passion Paradox with past Run to the Top guest Brad Stolberg. He's also the author of The Science of Running, and collectively, his books have sold more than 250,000 copies in print, ebook, and audio formats. Steve co-hosts two podcasts, The Growth Equation with Brad Stolberg and On Coaching with Magnus and Marcus with John Marcus. His writing has also appeared in Runner's World and Sports Illustrated, and he's been featured in The New Yorker, Wall Street Journal, The New York Times, Men's Health, The Guardian, Business Insider, and ESPN, and more. In Steve's new book, Do Hard Things, he explores the concept of mental toughness and how our view of it has changed over the generations. But where the book gets really good is when he talks about the four pillars of mental toughness and how we can actually apply the concepts to ourselves and our own running. It's kind of like a mental recipe book for our brains. Steve is someone whose work I've admired for a long time, and I'm delighted to bring you our conversation. Today's episode is sponsored by Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers. Their industry-leading magnesium supplement is organic and contains all seven forms of magnesium, which help you sleep better and reduce stress. I'll tell you more about how magnesium can help you improve your sleep later on in the episode. This podcast is brought to you by MetPro, a world-renowned concierge nutrition, fitness, and lifestyle coaching company. Using metabolic profiling, the MetPro team of experts analyzes your metabolism and provides an individualized approach to attaining your goals. Run to the Top listeners receive a complimentary metabolic profiling assessment and a 30-minute consultation with a MetPro expert. To claim this offer, head to metpro.co/RTTT. And now, here's Steve Magnus. Welcome to the Run to the Top, Steve.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So most runners understand the importance of mental strength or mental toughness when they're training and racing because, you know, running's hard. Running hard is hard. And if you have any mental edge, that can help you reach your potential. So, but, you know, the word toughness kind of has some different connotations. Can you talk about this and what it means with respect to running?
Yeah, definitely. So often when we think about toughness, we kind of, you know, latch onto images of like, oh, I'm just going to push through the pain and do really difficult things and all that good stuff and just grind or grit my way through things. And that is certainly true. But in writing and researching Do Hard Things, my book, what I found is that that's not the only path. Mm-hmm. In runners, we know this, right? When you're sitting there in the middle of the depths of despair, in the middle of the marathon, yes, putting your head down and trying to force your way through can get you somewhere, but you also know that that fails as often as it succeeds, and you better have more tools in your toolbox to get through the pain or discomfort. So what I'm trying to do is like almost take a runner's approach to toughness, where sometimes you're going to have to accept the pain. Sometimes you're going to have a conversation with it. Sometimes you're going to push through, but it's about like figuring out the best way to navigate through whatever discomfort you're experiencing in that moment. That's what being tough is about. It's not, you know, just grinding through and pushing through no matter what.
So do you think that some people have just a more innate sense of toughness or resilience than other people? Or is this just something that it's a learned skill, anybody can do it?
Yeah, I mean, to me, it's a learned skill, anybody can do it. And actually, my work with runners and other athletes tells me that it's a learned skill, and the research backed that up as well. It's like anything. We can get better at it. Are some people more naturally in tune to it, or does it come, you know, easily? Sure, absolutely. But all of us can get better, because it's no different than any other skill set, in the sense that if you can learn to accept the pain or understand what, you know, the pain or discomfort or fatigue or various emotions that come with it, like the better you can understand that stuff, the better you can navigate and deal with it. So for sure, everybody from, you know, your weekend warrior to your Olympic champion can work on this stuff.
Yeah. Well, that's some inspiring news for some people, because, you know, there are some athletes that, you know, even that they're just going out for a track workout, you know, they got 400 meter repeats, whatever it is. And they just get so nervous, and they have to hit that 400 in X amount of seconds. And they just, you know, get so caught up in their head that they, you know, sabotage their success. So, and then other people are just like, yeah, whatever, I'm just going to run a bunch of 400s and just whatever happens, happens. So like, what are some tools that we can use, you know, to kind of quell that anxiety?
Yeah, that's a good question. Before I answer that, I want to like drive home this point, because this was really fascinating. In researching the book, I just started talking to, first off, a ton of high-class, world-class runners, because that's like my bread and butter, right? And I just started asking this question, like, what's going through your head, like before a big race, or what's going through your head in the middle of, you know, the Boston Marathon when you're competing, you know, for the win? And inevitably, everybody had a story of saying like, oh yeah, I wanted to find a hole to step in, or like to find a curb to step on to like, you know, get me out of this experience. Every single athlete, I'm talking, you know, American record holders, medalists, everybody I talked to all had their own quote unquote step in a hole moment where they wanted to quit. So like, to me, that's refreshing, because it's a human thing. It's right. It's not that like these best athletes in the world, the ones winning major marathons, don't experience this thing. They experience the same like doubt, fatigue, anxiety, insecurities that the rest of us do. So I think that's important, because once we see it as something that's like, doesn't mean that you're weak or dysfunctional, and instead it's just something that we all experience, it becomes something that we can deal with.
Okay.
And when we're looking at anxiety, right, that's part of it, right? Anxiety comes from things that almost like we blow up to mean, or blow up to be more important or more meaningful or more real than they actually are. Mm-hmm. And so anxiety is just our brain saying like, hey, you're about to do something that's really difficult and might be in public and might, you know, put you in a situation where you quote unquote might fail. So our brain's going to tell you to freak out so that like you're protecting yourselves.
Right.
So a lot of it is like dealing with that that reality. You know, I talked to a good friend who was a finalist at the Olympic trials, and I said, what were you doing, you know, leading up to that race? It was track trials. What were you doing like when you're about to get on the starting line? And she was like, oh, I was freaking out. I said, okay, like how'd you deal with that? She said, well, you know, I sat there and reminded myself that, yeah, this might seem like a big deal, but it's not life and death. And in reality, I'm running around in circles around a track that like in a sport that, yeah, it's popular, but like if I make it or if I don't and I get dead last, like the only people who are really going to care are me and my coach and my parents at home.
Right. Right.
And I think sometimes like one of the best ways to deal with anxiety is to frame it correctly so that you understand, okay, this isn't life or death. My mind, my brain thinks that I'm on the savannah getting hunted by a lion, but it's not a lion. Like I'm going to be okay.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great point. And in one section in your book, you talk about these feelings, you know, and I try to say to people when they're, you know, nervous about something like that, you know, feelings aren't facts. They are something else, but it's not a fact. But we shouldn't push away our feelings. Our feelings are actually important, even though they're crazy and telling us we're freaking out, right? Those feelings are important. Can you explain that?
Yeah, sure. So feelings are the way that our body essentially communicates with us. So it's just sending us a message. Anxiety, as I said, is sending us a message that, hey, there's something that might be a little bit threatening in your environment. So you might want to deal with it. You know, the pain of fatigue that we feel in a race, like that's a feeling or emotion as well. That's telling you, hey, you're redlining a little bit. Like you might want to, you know, keep your eyes up. You might want to figure out if you're pushing too hard or not in this moment. Now, the great thing is that, as you said, some of those messages are going to be accurate and some of them are more like, you know, our ranting aunt or uncle on Facebook where we can see it.
Yeah.
Right. We see it. We acknowledge it, but then we just kind of move on by. We say, yeah, okay, they're just kind of going crazy. We can see it, but we don't need to give value to that message.
Yes. Yes. That's actually a really classic technique, disassociation, you know, giving your negative voice like a name or something like that. So you can, you know, accept that voice is on board, but not necessarily listen to the crazy uncle, right?
Right. Exactly. I think naming things is one of the most powerful tools that we have in our toolbox, because a lot of this is if you name it, and you understand it, then you learn to not be afraid of it.
Mm.
It's the uncertainty that's wrapped up in all this stuff that causes our mind to freak out, where we say, oh my gosh, like, what if this happens? Like, what if I collapse or can't finish or whatever have you? It's the uncertainty around it. So if we create structure and we name it, we say, hey, I understand what this is, what you're trying to say, but I'm in control and I get to decide whether I listen or not. That's incredibly powerful. And runners know this. I mean, this is why I love talking to runners, because we get it, I think, more than any other sport possible. But, you know, one of the early lessons we all learn is distinguishing between something that's just like a pain and something that's an injury.
Right.
Right. Like you have to be able to distinguish is like, hey, is this a little ache that, you know, is left over from the hard workout I did yesterday? Or is this something that could turn into a potential injury that keeps me out for weeks and months? Mm-hmm. You have to learn the nuance of that language that your body is sending in terms of the feelings and sensations. Well, every other emotion is and feeling is the same. Right. We have to understand, if we understand the nuance, then we can understand, hey, this is something that I can run through like a pain, or is this, this is something where I should just like call it quits, like stop, I'm doing myself damage.
Right. Right. And so how do we as coaches help guide athletes through some of this stuff? Because, you know, there's been a lot of successful coaches in a lot of different sports that, you know, had some pretty authoritarian styles that became very famous and very successful. And then, you know, maybe there's some ones we haven't heard about that are also successful that have, you know, a gentler approach. And you talk about some of these examples in the book.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that it was really fascinating is finding like these historical examples of coaches who I would just call them old school. And we all know like what that means. It's like your old school high school football coach or PE coach who just yells and screams at you and tells you that like this is how you get tougher. This is how you become disciplined. Like it's entirely from like an authoritarian kind of control mechanism. And we often think like, oh, this is the path, right? You have like Bobby Knight, who was famous for winning and having discipline teamed and all that stuff. But he also lost his cool. But anyways, we tend to think of like that model as like the disciplinarian. This is how you get tougher. But what research clearly shows is it actually backfires.
Mm.
And you actually have lower rates of discipline. You have lower, like you have worse levels of persistence. And it's pretty clear why. Because you're only motivated when that like scary figure is in your life yelling at you. Mm-hmm. But as soon as they leave, like that motivation goes away. And if you look at most things that we do, especially as runners, like, yeah, sure, our coach is on the sidelines, but in a cross country race or a marathon, we might see them like once or twice,
right?
It's you alone in your head having to navigate this. The motivation on the sideline of someone yelling and screaming at you isn't going to do it. It mm-hmm. has to come from like within and come from you. So what research, practice, everything right now shows is that it's not the authoritarian style that gets us as coaches, gets the best out of people. It's when we are supportive and give them a secure environment where they can take risks and explore like the fatigue and discomfort that comes with things.
Right.
So it's like competing out of a place of like exploration and joy and seeing what you can do versus competing out of a place of fear. Bad things happen when we're afraid.
Yeah, we quit when we're afraid, right? And we don't, you know, push the pace because we would rather quit and, you know, not cross the finish line and because of whatever reason than try our hardest and fail. Because that's like the ego gets involved there. If we tried and failed, that's one thing. But if we quit and failed, that's another. That's a little easier for some people.
Exactly. You're spot on. It's like that ego is so powerful. It goes back to it's a safety mechanism, right? It's a protective mechanism. And remember back to high school and you understand this. Like, you know, you'd take a test and you wouldn't study intentionally sometimes because you'd be like, well, I didn't get the highest grade or I didn't do that well. But you know what? I didn't study. So it wasn't really reflective of what I'm capable of. Mm-hmm. We do the same thing in performing at races, whatever have you. Not trying or quitting is a protective mechanism because then we get to walk away and we get to say, well, if I tried, I would have, you know, reached mm-hmm. my goal, or I would have won the race, or I would have done X, Y, and Z. So it really takes, you know, this like inner security that also comes from coaches to like get beyond that and be like, you know what? It's okay if you risk and you fail. Like, it's fine. Like, we're going to live to fight another day. You're going to learn and grow from it. But having that ability to like put yourself out there takes a lot of security and confidence.
Yeah, that's a perfect segue into my next question, security and confidence. So confidence is something you talk about, and it's, you know, you look at people who are successful in running or whatever, and they walk into a room and they have confidence, and you think, oh, they're more successful than I am because they are confident. And yet there's some nuance there with confidence. You don't just become confident, you know, unless you're faking it. You can fake it and that works for a while, but you say faking it till you make it, it's probably not the best choice.
Yeah, what the research and practice shows is pretty clear is that faking it works on easy things.
Mm.
So if, you know, if I need to show up and give a presentation in front of, you know, 15 of my coworkers, I can fake it. And it'll give me a momentary bump in confidence and I'll be okay. Why? Because standing up in front of people who you don't know isn't actually, or who you do know, excuse me, isn't actually that threatening. But if I tried the same thing in front of, you know, a auditorium of thousands of people, then like faking it would backfire because your brain would be like, hey, wait a minute. You actually don't know what you're doing. You
right.
don't, you're not prepared. It's no different than, you know, if I signed up to, for a, you know, a mile fun run and I could fake my way through, maybe not fast, but to finish. But if I tried for a marathon, like faking it would, backfire completely. Same thing.
Right.
So,
right.
What matters more when it comes to confidence is that, you know, our confidence is founded in doing the work, meaning there's like actual evidence behind it that kind of gives us this quiet inner confidence. And you, right. again, you talk to any runner and they're aware of this, right? Where do you get your confidence from leading up to a race? You look back on the work you've done.
Mm-hmm.
You say, you know what? I'm nervous, but I'm prepared. Like I did everything possible. I did all my long runs. I put in my mileage. I did those workouts or those tempo runs. Like that's where real confidence comes from because it's based and founded on something real.
But I have to ask the question. So how do you have confidence when you're trying to do something you've never done before? You know, most people toe the line at a marathon, hoping for a PR, trying to do something they have never done before. So how can they have confidence that they can actually do it?
That's a very good question. And what I'd say there is, what did you do preparing for that marathon? You trusted the process that if I followed this training program, if I listen to my coach who has this experience, then I'm going to be prepared to do it, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not pulling it out of thin air. It's saying, hey, it's almost like putting your ego aside. You're saying like, hey, I've never done this before, but I'm following the guidance of a coach or I'm training with this group who has a lot of people who have done this before. Mm-hmm. So it's not necessarily like we have to derive our confidence as coming from, hey, there's no doubts. There's like, I've got this in the bag. It's more of like embracing reality of, yes, this is going to be really difficult. Yes, I'm not sure if I'm going to hit my marathon goal, but I know for 100% fact that I did all the workouts. I put in the work. I listened to my coach. I showed up on Sunday for my long runs with my teammates. And that's all I can do. It's almost like having that assurity that like, I've done everything I can to prepare for this. And what happens after this is like, you know, down to execution and a little bit of luck.
You've heard us talk a lot about the benefits of magnesium over the past few weeks, including how it can improve your sleep, boost your performance, strengthen bones, reduce cramps, and help you recover faster. And you've also heard me recommend Magnesium Breakthrough from Bioptimizers because it contains all 7 forms of magnesium. But now Bioptimizers have taken it a step further with the release of their new and improved formula, which now includes cofactors like B6 and manganese that help with the absorption of magnesium. In a lot of the recent scientific literature, combining magnesium with B6 was shown to facilitate cellular uptake of magnesium and increase its effectiveness. This is why we love the products from Bioptimizers. They are always using the latest research to tweak their formulas and make your supplements even better. And magnesium is one of the most important supplements you can take as a runner, considering it's involved in 80% of the body's metabolic reactions and 75% of runners are not getting enough magnesium in their diet. So if you want to see the difference magnesium can make in your recovery, sleep, and overall mood, we've partnered with them to give you an offer of 10% off. Just head to magbreakthrough.com/run to the top and use the code RUN10 to save 10% on Magnesium Breakthrough. Simply take 2 capsules before you go to bed and you'll be amazed by the improvements in your mood and energy levels and just how much more rested you feel when you wake up. As you know, 2 of the most important pillars for everything we do at Runners Connect center around individualization and science. That's why when it comes to nutrition plans and losing weight, we highly recommend the coaching team at MetPro. First, the science. MetPro analyzes your individual metabolism to get a baseline to see exactly how your body is responding against a very specific set of variables. This means no cookie-cutter diets or formulas. With this personal data in hand, MetPro coaches create your meal plan based on what works for your body. No guessing involved. Your MetPro coach then works with you to consistently make adjustments based on your metabolic data, as well as how your plan fits your lifestyle. MetPro's coaches are not only educated experts in their field, but they're empathetic that people have demanding schedules and often stressful lives. They will work one-on-one with you to identify the best nutrition and fitness strategy that is going to work for your personal goals and your lifestyle needs. MetPro's team of experts has worked with the most recognizable names in sports, entertainment, and business. They've helped thousands of individuals transform their bodies by hacking their metabolism. If you're looking for a high-touch experience working with a metabolic expert, or if you want access to the tools their industry-leading coaches use, visit metpro.co/RTTT to take their assessment and speak with their team to learn which option is best for you. Listeners will also get up to 1 month free when they sign up. Head to metpro.co/RTTT to take advantage of this opportunity. For those entered in our monthly prize giveaway, the secret code for this week is recovery. If you're not sure what the giveaway or the secret code means, head to runnersconnect.net/giveaway. Each month, we're giving away a new grand prize. Plus, you can earn points to unlock free programs, books, RC swag, and more. You can then earn points by entering the secret code or by sharing the podcast with your friends, leaving reviews, and more. This month, we are giving away our best and most exclusive prize yet. It's a free spot at one of our amazing running retreats this year. Take your pick of beautiful Flagstaff, Arizona, July 7th through 11th, incredible Lake Tahoe, California, August 10th through 14th, or picturesque Lake Winnipesaukee, New Hampshire, September 22nd through 25th. Experience breathtaking runs, amazing running trails, one-on-one coaching, and a group of like-minded runners. Take a trip to the Grand Canyon, run along the pristine blue waters of Lake Tahoe, or watch the fall leaves change in New Hampshire. Everything is provided for you with this unbelievable prize, including your food, accommodations, and activities on the retreat. All you have to do is get yourself there. Again, to see all the details and to enter, head to runnersconnect.net/giveaway and get started by entering and then adding this week's secret code, recovery. Yeah. So embracing reality is one of your pillars of mental toughness that you talk about. And I'd love to get into this one because, you know, there's a lot of people who, getting ready for a big race, they'll visualize what the race is going to be like, which is a great technique. You know, they'll imagine that time they want on the clock. They'll imagine everything going right. And then on race day, as soon as they drop their water bottle or their shoe comes untied, everything unravels. So I would love to talk about how you embrace the reality of bad things happening.
Yeah, that's such a good point, and something that has happened to all of us, myself included there, is often I think we fool ourselves and we think like, oh, I have to be incredibly optimistic. Like I have to think that everything's going right. I have to visualize, as you said, like everything going according to plan. But what happens there is you're setting yourself up for unrealistic expectations, right? Mm-hmm. You're setting yourself up for like, I'm going to feel great. I'm going to come through the half marathon on PR pace. I'm going to get all my bottles. I'm not going to have any trouble like getting my fluid down, all that good stuff. And that perfect day, like very rarely comes, you know, only a handful of times in our career. And they're great, but it doesn't come that often. More likely than not, something is going to happen. Something's going to go in your way. And if you set yourself only up for perfection, the moment that you miss that bottle, your split is a little slow, your brain goes from like, oh, everything's going great to, oh dear God, we're not going to like hit our goal, like throw in the towel, freak out, everything's done, because you set your expectations too high. Right. So that's where I think embracing reality is important. It's not being like a Debbie Downer or even a realistic. It's kind of being like a, I'd call it like a tragic optimist, meaning you're like, you're like hopeful for the future. You're hopeful it's going to work out, but you're just a little part of your mind is prepared, right?
Right. Yeah.
You know, you've visualized what to do if you miss a bottle, or you mm-hmm. visualize what happens if it all of a sudden it's really windy and you're a little slow or what have you. You've prepared for the things that could go wrong so that you don't jump straight from like, oh, this is a little tough, to like, you know, I'm done, freak out.
Yes, great advice. And another thing that I really liked was the concept of raising the floor. So we all have, you know, whatever time goal, if we're racing for time. And so we're like, oh, this is my shoot for this, you know, the everything's perfect, shoot the moon goal. That's my A goal. And then maybe this is my B goal. But nobody talks about that floor. We talk about the bar, but we don't talk about the floor. So what does raising the floor mean?
Yeah. So this was one that actually came about from some athletes that I coach. They were talking about this one day and I'm like, this is brilliant. You're like, you guys are spot on. And what it basically means is the floor is our kind of minimal acceptable race or our minimal acceptable performance, where even if we show up and we're tired and we're fatigued and things aren't going well, we're still going to be capable of X performance. Mm. And I think so often, like you said, we focus on, oh, the PR day, like raising the ceiling, shooting for the stars, all that stuff. But what I've learned as a coach is that those big performances show up or come up when you are consistently showing up. So to consistently show up is about raising that floor so that even on a bad day, you're still going to run, I don't know, a 2:30 marathon. On mm-hmm. your best day, you might run 2:20. But right. if you can always know that you're going to show up and you're going to run, hey, even if I fall apart, I'm going to run about 2:30. And when we reframe things like that, it makes it where we're not just like reaching for the highest goal, but we're getting that consistent standard. One mm-hmm. athlete who I think does this really well, who I worked with in the past, is Sarah Hall.
Ah.
If you look at her, she like shows up, she races all the time, and sometimes it's lights out, but other times it's just pretty dang good, you know? Yeah. And I think that's what you see with a lot. Molly Huddle is another great example. Like you see this with a lot of really good runners, in particular female runners, for whatever reason, who, you know, they just have a certain standard of excellence and they're always going to be in that sphere, even if they don't feel that great. And what that tells me is if we can raise the floor high enough, then when it comes time to like, hey, everything's clicking, then you're going to be able to like hit that ceiling or raise that ceiling even more so.
Yeah. Yeah. Great example. Both of those women kind of have the reputation of being grinders, you know, just grinding away and grinding away. So clearly they've got some mental tools in the toolbox.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So the next pillar that we touched on a little bit is listen to your body. So, you know, when I hear people say, oh, just listen to your body, I say, you know, it's kind of new agey and it's kind of like your body lies to you a lot. So your body really wants to protect you from doing anything stupid and getting eaten by the lion on the savannah, you know? So how do you really listen to your body? How can you trust your body?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think when people hear listen to your body, I think they think they think that, you know, the body's always telling them like the correct answer. And as you said, it's not true. We can listen to it and still think like, you know what? I'm just going to ignore that advice, or I'm going to put this over here. So listening to your body is really about like reading it, right? Mm. It's not necessarily following it. It's you want to understand and speak this. You want to know what language it's speaking. And what research, both in sport and then more importantly, in terms of like getting over handling traumatic experiences shows us is that if we can like create nuance around and understand the nuance that our body is communicating, both in terms of like what we're feeling, but also the voices that kind of pop into our head, then we're able to deal with it better because we know the language it's speaking. We're like, okay, like, no, I'm not going to listen to this one because like, this is just you freaking out and there's nothing wrong. Or to, you know, listen to it. You know, the other example I like to give is I was speaking to some very accomplished climbers who, you know, did things like summit Mount Everest. And they tell me, you know, the toughest thing wasn't getting to the top of the mountain. It's when you were like, the summit was in reach. You could see it. You could feel it. You're like, oh, I'm almost hitting your goal. But then to like zoom out and read your body and understand, do I have the energy to make it to the top and all the way back down?
Right.
Not just to make it to the goal, but I need to make sure that I can make it all the way down because so many of the accidents actually occur coming back down from the top. And I thought that was such a brilliant example because it's like reading your body in the toughest moment when you've spent a lot of times years training to like reach this goal of summiting the mountain, but you got to zoom out and say, hey, where are my energy levels at? Because unlike in a marathon, like if I bonk, I just kind of walk to the finish line. If I bonk here, like I'm dead.
Right. Right. You better get really good at listening to your body up there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. So the next one is respond, don't react. So, you know, I think it's our nature to be reactive. Something, you know, big, shiny object in front of us, we want to go towards it. And we just react without even thinking sometimes. So how can we train ourselves to respond thoughtfully?
Yeah. And that word you use right there is the key, thoughtfully. Because what often happens is everything in really hard situations, everything is kind of compressed. Mm-hmm. So we feel a little bit of pain and fatigue. All of a sudden, like our brain starts spiraling and our mental talk goes negative, and we're like looking for that hole to step in or that reason to quit. It's like very compressed. So that's like why we tend to react, because it's so compressed that we tend to think like, oh my gosh, I'm in real trouble here. I've got to do something. Like that nature to do something, that pull is very strong. The way to respond, not to react, is to create space. So if you can create space, then like it's almost like a snowball spiraling down a mountain. Like if it grows rapidly, we're in trouble. If we can slow that thing down, then it doesn't grow. It's not as big. It's not as hard to deal with. So it's about like creating that space so that we can like navigate it. And
so is it like, you know, this too shall pass, you know, that kind of thing? Yeah. Or what are you saying to yourself? Like, what is the actual tool that we can use to create some space?
Yeah. So there's a bunch of different things. The way I like to conceptualize it is like using the phrase zooming, meaning oftentimes when we're in that heat of the battle moment, we're like so zoomed in and focused, we can't like zoom out.
Right.
So you need to do things that allows you to like get some perspective or create some distance. So a couple tools you can use, right? You can shift your attention. Right. Instead of like being so hyper aware of what I'm doing and how I'm feeling and all that stuff, you can look at your competitors, like shift your attention to the crowd, shift your attention to looking for your coach or family in the audience. Right. You're changing your attention, which then can like drag the rest of you with it and say, oh, yes, like this feeling of fatigue or pain isn't the only thing going on in the world. Another strategy as well is like the self-talk we use, right? So a lot of times it becomes like very personal and very like me focused when we're in the thick of it. And again, if we can drag that out and create some space, it allows us to deal with this. Well, how do you do this? Some very fascinating research shows that if you use second or third person, right?
Yes.
You say your name and you say, Steve's got this.
Yes.
It, as crazy as that sounds, what it does is it like activates a part in your brain that like makes you able to deal with it where it feels a little less personal and a little more detached. So you can say, you know what? No, like this isn't that bad.
I love that technique. Distance self-talk is great. You know, you hear super famous athletes, you know, LeBron James is going to do what LeBron James is going to do, you know, talk about themselves in third person. And you think, why in the world are they doing that? But it's actually a scientifically proven technique that really works. It's crazy.
Yeah. You know, it's wild. At first you're just like, man, look at the ego on this person. Like, right. but it works. And one of the more interesting things I've done recently is talk to some tennis athletes who are pretty good. And they were like, go watch like a high level tennis match. I'm like, I never watched tennis. So, okay. Like we'll go flip on Rafael Nadal or whatever. And you watch them in between, I don't even know what it's called, sets, plays, whatever you want to call it, right? And they're sitting there talking to themselves out loud. And every once in a while, like you'll hear it, and they're saying their names lots of time. But the other part, key part is they're talking to themselves out loud. And if you look at the research, again, it's fascinating because it says like when we verbalize it, it's almost like we tap into like a more primitive, you know, part of our brain that like responds to that. Because if you think of it, or what research also shows, the science shows, is that, you know, early on in our life, like we probably don't have a robust inner voice, a robust inner world. We tend to verbalize it. It's why babies or toddlers walk around and like will say exactly what they're thinking and doing. It's only once our brain has developed that outer voice moves inside. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of reverse engineer this and talk to yourself like out loud. And I know that sounds crazy, but it taps into, again, this like almost primitive nature where it's like, oh yes, this is how we used to like communicate or give ourselves directions or think about stuff. And it can create that space again, because your brain almost gets jolted where it's like, okay, like, yeah, zoom out, like get out of your head. We're okay.
Well, it's also because it's like somebody else is talking to you. Like you have a coach, you're your own coach. And we're so social that when we hear another voice, even though it's our own talking out loud, we associate it with another person talking to us. Right?
Right. 100%. Yeah. I mean, that's spot on. So it's funny, like you think of all these things and sometimes they seem like a little absurd, but they're just ways to almost like trick your brain to like get out of the freak out moment, get out of the doom spiral of like, we can't get out of this.
Yeah. See, this is how you fake it till you make it. You think these things are silly and you have to fake them. And then you do it. You're like talking to yourself. You got to fake that at first. But it's easy. It's an easy task. So it works, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So transcend discomfort. Please, Steve, tell us how to transcend discomfort. This is what everybody in the world wants to know.
Oh man. If I had the actual answer, I'd be a millionaire. But
yeah.
So what I mean by this is pretty simple, is that to really deal with difficult things, like it has to be more than just us. Okay. Mm. It can't just be like selfish or ego, like, you know, me wanting to make some money or win a prize or what have you. Is we have to have like purpose and meaning behind it. And then we have to have like support others around us that are like part of our village that are in this journey with us together. Mm. And if we can have those two things, that meaning, that community, that purpose behind it, then we're able to withstand some pretty incredible things. And this goes beyond, you know, beyond just the discomfort in running. This goes to handling incredibly difficult or harrowing experiences in life. As mm-hmm. if you can see it beyond this, just yourself and your narrow view of the world, then you're able to withstand things.
Yeah. Yeah. That, well, you know, the first thing that comes to my head when you say that we need the support system, you know, the deeper meaning. A lot of people listening to this show are, you know, recreational runners. You know, they might be advanced runners. They're doing this despite what their wife thinks, despite what their husband thinks. They're running, getting up at 5 a.m, running alone before the kids get up, and they don't always feel that support, you know. But, you know, so what do you say to them? How do you transcend discomfort when, you know, running is just your passion?
Well, I think it's almost even more important with the regular folks, because it's not your job, right? You don't get paid to do it. Like, you're choosing to go out the door every day and go through this pain and discomfort that doesn't always feel that good and is often tiring, but like, for whatever reason, you get out the door and you do it again. And what I would say to that is, like, this is the importance of, like, your running community. If you can find training partners, if you have a coach, if you have support, some sort of support group that helps, like, anything like that, that gives you this kind of, this is not just me trudging out the door to get things done. And again, I'm like the science nerd, so I'll turn to this, but there was this fascinating study that took a bunch of runners, cross country runners actually, and put them at the bottom of like an incredibly steep hill. Mm-hmm. And when they were standing there alone, they had them guess, like, how steep do you think this hill is? And they'd be like, you know, 20 degrees, whatever it is. And they say it's super steep. Well, then, you know, later on, they take them back and they'd stick their training partner next to them, or a different hill, sorry. So it was actually, yeah, a slightly different hill that was as steep. And they'd stick their training partner next to them and be like, how steep do you think this hill is? They were more accurate and thought it was like less difficult when their training partner was near them.
Mm.
Because like, when we have that support, like, the challenging stuff, the harrowing stuff seems a little bit more manageable, because we know, you know, if we fail, it's okay. We've got friends, we've got support, like, we're going to be okay. So in your own running, like, create that community. And sometimes it doesn't even have to be in person, right? That's the beauty of what we have now, is like, use Strava for some good, right?
Right. Like, right.
Create community and connection there, where people feel like, you know, they're involved in your journey to complete your first 10K or half marathon or marathon or whatever have you. Or more importantly, you know, if you're trying to do a marathon for the first time, sign up for a good cause, right?
Yes.
Like, that gives you community, but it also gives you purpose, where it's like, hey, this isn't just about me. I'm doing this to help others for something that's far greater than just me checking the box on something that is difficult to do.
Yeah, great. So how do you suggest that runners practice all these techniques? Let's say we give them a whole, you know, shoebox full of tools, and, you know, the whole thing, you know, talking to yourself in third person, mantras, you know, on and on and on. We give them a whole bunch of mental tools. Do you suggest that we practice them just like our running workouts? You know, Monday, we're going to work on mantras. Tuesday, we're going to work on talking to ourselves in third person, you know? So how does one actively practice mental strength techniques?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think this is often where the rubber hits the road, because like, yes, we have all these cool things that we can do, but they're only as good as like your capacity to use them. Meaning, it's just like your muscle. Like, your mental muscle can grow stronger the more robust that we use it, like the more frequently we use it. So you have to practice this stuff. So I'm a big believer in like being intentional, which means, just like you have goals for, you know, your workouts on the physical side, you go out for a, you know, 400 meter repeats and you say, hey, I need to run these in 90 seconds, whatever it is. You have some sort of goal that you're trying to accomplish to get things. I think the same thing should be done on the mental side, is like, give yourself a strategy that fits with like the demands of the workout you're going through, and say, hey, today I'm going to work on this. I'm going to get a little bit better, or I'm going to explore what it looks like for using, different self-talk, whatever it is. Mm-hmm. And the way I like to do it is as well as say, hey, use these in the hard workouts, but not the most important workouts.
Why is that?
Because the most important workouts are the ones that you just want like naturally for you to get through to handle. If you're worried about like trying these different mental techniques, often they can backfire because you're trying new things.
Gotcha.
So you want to like try it in the workouts that are hard, but they're not like, hey, this is my big indicator workout for the Boston Marathon to see if I'm ready, right? Mm-hmm. There you just want to like do whatever you can to like make it through and get okay. But in the other workouts, maybe instead of the marathon simulator, you're doing 800s on the track, which isn't as important for the marathon, but it's still difficult. You say, okay, I'm going to try these techniques. Because if something doesn't work well and like mentally I spiral and get frustrated, it's not the end of the world.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. So what kind of research would you like done in the future? Where do we still have to go in this subject? What questions do you still have that you'd like some answers?
Yeah, that's a really good question. You know, I think there's so much we don't know on the psychological or mental side of performance, mostly because it's almost like a black box. We can't really measure things really well. So we kind of just take guesses, and even our best measurement systems, like you're stuck in a tube, an MRI tube in an office. Like you're not going to be running while you're looking at your brain, right? So I would love to see more work on like really high class performers and like undercovering, you know, what their mental process looks like, and maybe like some of the underlying neuroscience of it. You're starting to see this and some world-class performers in other sports. In the book, I talk about Alex Honnold and climbing, who's the famous free soloist, how they've done brain scans on him and stuff like that. Obviously not when climbing, but you can get an idea. I'd love to see that with runners.
Yeah.
Because my bias, but I think runners are like the toughest people on the planet. So there's so much we can learn, I think, not just in sports performance, but also like that applies to, you know, going through traumas, going through like traumatic experiences of your life, like handling the daily grind of work and living and parenting and all those good things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Alex Honnold, he's like, you know, flatlined, you know, like he has no fear of anything. Nothing bugs him. He's just cool as a cucumber while he's hanging off El Capitan. So when does the book come out?
Yeah. So it comes out June 21st.
Awesome. Well, I think that's a good place to wrap it up, Steve. But before I let you go, I'm going to ask you a few questions that I ask everyone, and I can't wait to hear your answers to these. So if you could go back and talk to yourself when you first started running, what advice would you give yourself?
Chill out. and the reason is because like quickly is that I was like obsessive about running. I mean, I'm still am, but like what you don't realize is that like the obsession, the striving for perfection gets in the way. So it's not about striving for perfection. It's like being excellent, whatever that means to you on your day, on your, you know, that you're capable of.
Great advice. What's the greatest gift running has given you?
That's a good question. I would probably say, you know, it goes back to the friendships, right?
Yeah.
The bonds that I've created through running from high school to college to just recreationally, like there's nothing quite like hard work that forms lasting bonds. There's something about like going through something difficult together and getting on the other side that just like creates friendships that last a long time.
Very well said. That's probably the most popular answer to that question, which I think is strange because running is such a solitary sport, and yet we find all our friends. It's just Yeah, you find your tribe. And finally, Steve, where can listeners connect with you?
Yeah, so you can check me out on Twitter, Instagram, all those things at Steve Magnus. And then check out the weekly newsletter that I do, which is at thegrowtheq.com.
Perfect. Well, this has been a pleasure, Steve, to have you on the Run to the Top. I'm so glad that you took the time to share your expertise with us.
Thanks so much for having me. This was a blast.
I have to say that the mental side of the sport is one of the most fascinating aspects of running for me. After all, we runners are purposely putting ourselves in a physically challenging and difficult situation every time we train hard or race hard. It seems counterintuitive and perhaps even masochistic to do this to ourselves on purpose. Yet, if you've ever run hard or raced hard, you know that overcoming challenges makes you feel more alive. But just learning about mental coping techniques by listening to a podcast or reading about it in a book is probably not going to get you too far. You actually have to practice them in training to make sure they're second nature. It's just like practicing your fueling and what you'll wear on race day. You have to practice what you'll say to yourself when things get hard, because they will. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. And thanks to all of you that have written a review on iTunes recently. You really are making a difference in the reach of this show, and I can't thank you enough. Thanks for listening to the Run to the Top podcast with me, Claire Bartholik, the Planted Runner. Our mission is to help you become a better runner with every episode. Connect with me on Instagram at The Planted Runner and at Runners Connect. Join the Runners Connect team at runnersconnect.net and support our show for free with a review on Apple Podcasts. If you love the show and want to get more free content in your inbox, become one of my favorite listeners and get the elite treatment at runnersconnect.net/podcast. Have a great run today.